The first reading this morning comes from the book Rebel in Thought by Sarah Tarleton Colvin. The date of this reading, I think, is the most significant part of it. 65 years ago, in 1944, listen to what she was saying back then.
We are all gradually learning that under our economic system of free enterprise, adequate medical services can never be paid for as a private cost.
And the second reading is a story that some of you may have heard before. It comes from the Gospel of Mark. It was written around the year 71 as a response to the Roman-Jewish War of the year 66 to 70. And this is in all of the New Testament, this story is the one that has the most variants in the various manuscripts that have come down to us. I hope all of you know that there's no such thing as the original Gospel of Mark. There's lots of different versions of it. The scholars have found tremendously different readings because the story is so disturbing, they try to temper it down, is what we think. This is probably the closest we can get to what Mark wrote.
And a man with a dreaded skin disease came up to him, fell to his knees and pleaded with him, "If you dare, you can declare me clean." So, fuming, he stretched out his hand, touched him, and said, "I dare. I now declare you clean." The skin disease faded right then, and he was indeed clean. Then, still growling with indignation, he ordered the man not to talk with anyone, but instead instructed him, "Go on back and present yourself to the official in charge of such things, and then make the offering prescribed by Moses to celebrate a cleansing as a witness against them." The man left, but only to make the whole story public. He spread the news far and wide until Jesus could no longer show his face in any town, but could only stay out of bounds in the countryside. Even so, people from all over the area sought him out frequently.
It's an interesting week this week. I started off going in a very different direction with this sermon, and as the week went on, I got hauled over by all kinds of other concerns, and so this is a very different sermon than I imagined I originally was going to preach. One of the most amazing pieces of theater that I've ever seen was a staging of Philip Glass's opera Satyagraha. It's the story of Mahatma Gandhi's life in South Africa before he moved to India and before he became a world figure. The first act of the opera has to do with a harrowing incident in which Gandhi was riding on a train going to a business meeting. He had paid for a first-class ticket. The conductor saw that he had brown skin, which under South African law at that time slotted him into a category between white and black called colored. So they told him, the conductors, to get out of first class and to go down to third class, because first class was only reserved for whites. Gandhi refused, and so he was put off the train along with his bags. He spent the night on the station platform under the hard stars. He was so angry, he didn't sleep a wink. But as he fumed, he began to realize that he had a choice. He could either spend the entire rest of his life stewing, or he could get up and begin to set in motion reform programs to make sure that nothing like this ever happened again to anyone else anywhere. In the opera, the story is told three times. The first two times, it's told exactly the same way. There are lavish sets, an ornate period train with women in bustles carrying parasols, Gandhi in a nice business suit, linen tablecloths in the dining car, all typical details of the era. But it was enacted a third time. And the third time, everything was the same. The music was the same. The story was the same. But there were no sets. There was no train, no historic costumes, no dining car with linens. Just an empty stage and people in simple clothing without any ethnic reference. The scene was enacted again with the exact same motions. But this time you see the whole action without distraction. You see the young Gandhi being insulted, hurt, put down, stuffed into a category that by law insisted that he be rejected. No fancy parasols or polite curtsies to smooth things over. You see it for what it actually was, a brutal affair. But Gandhi wrote later that the anger he felt at that time was a kind of madness. That's his word. And he felt that if he didn't harness the anger, control the anger is his actual phrase, he would just spin his wheels and never get anything done. Anger and intolerance are both the enemies of correct understanding, he later wrote, reflecting on this incident. So on that night, under the stars on the train station platform, Gandhi decided to take his anger and to transform it into action that was neither impulsive and wild, but studied and deliberate. And the rest, as they say, is history. Today, the word anger is still in the news. Not Gandhi's anger, other people's anger. As healthcare proposals are being presented and debated, folks are spitting red-faced threats at their own senators, packing pistols in their boots, carrying signs with unusually cruel language. The President of the United States, who is championing this healthcare reform, is being accused as a response of every form of mayhem imaginable, with wild-eyed protesters making completely, I'll name it, insane claims as to his origin, not a citizen, they say, his motivations, to turn us all into a communist nation, and his soul filled with hatred for whites. One must suppose his own mother, too, since she was white, and his grandparents. These folks say they don't trust the government in D.C. They have no faith that Washington will do anything but make health care even worse than it already is. After all, I heard someone say the other day in a cafe, if you think insurance forms are hard to figure out now, wait till this new government-supported plan comes into effect. Think about your income tax forms and how angry they make you every year. Now imagine that anger rising up in you every time you have to fill out 100 small print forms just to get your government-sanctioned flu shot every year. And there are plenty of people angry about just that, flu shots, which they are convinced are going to do none of us any good at all. At the very least, these people don't like anyone telling them that they have to do anything, including get shots for their own health. So they're angry. Well, although I find many of the ways anger has been expressed recently very disturbing, this doesn't mean that I myself am immune to anger. In fact, just like these present-day ranters, I've been angry at various declarations that have come out of Washington, D.C. over the years. The famous threat of weapons of mass destruction was a lie, plain and simple, and that came out of Washington. It was simply intended to make us afraid, afraid to say anything, afraid to protest against that evil war. That falsehood, that lie infuriated me. And also, a bit like today's raging citizens, I get steamed whenever I encounter people who think they can tell me what to do and tell me I need to get with their religious program because mine is wrong. My anger, whether I bristle or whether it's tamped down to bitter frowns or passive-aggressive snorts, is indeed very real. But neither of these kinds of anger that I just described, fist being shaken at senators, or rage that I have been lied to by powers that be, is the same as the anger that Gandhi felt on that train platform. Even though he was hardly a perfected saint, Gandhi, on that day and through his anger, came in touch with the central idea that was to shape the rest of his life, namely, no one has the right to put anyone else into a category and then make and keep them second, third, and fourth class citizens just because they claim to have the power to do so. My anger and the anger of all these people I just described doesn't do any such thing. At the Bread Clergy Caucus on Thursday, we were asked to name things that angered us about our society. We did this in small groups. I found some quick anger in me because of friends, good friends that I have, who made mistakes when they were younger, committed a crime, suffered the penalty of prison for about a year, but then who, when they got out and tried to make something positive of their lives, can't do so because the record stays with them forever. Flick, just like that, their past life glows on every computer screen. It doesn't matter what they've done to better themselves, getting their GED, getting job training, doing therapy. It doesn't matter. They can't get hired, and they are told that their felony is the reason. Doesn't make any difference that it happened 15 years ago. Every sentence, you see, is a life sentence in Ohio and in most of the country. And this totally infuriates me. Now, that anger is a little bit more like the anger Gandhi felt on that train platform, much more authentically helpful to me and to my understanding of the world than my anger at presidential fibbing. It's anger directed at a certain kind of categorical thinking. Gandhi found out the hard way that his skin and ethnicity flung him into a second-class category and third-class seats. My friends have found out the hard way that their mistakes are permanent and that they are no longer hopeful like the rest of us, living from day to day hoping that things might get better, but they're permanent criminals, worthy of being disbarred from all chances at a real livelihood. Chances. Chances. There you have it. Luck. The real faith of our country. Not confidence in Jeffersonian high-mindedness and the Declaration or the Constitution. Not trust in Lincoln's fine speeches. Not trust in the Christian God, the Jewish God, the Muslim God, or even the generalized God of what sociologists call civil religion. Not faith in the principles of democracy or confidence in elected leadership. None of that. Just faith in the absolute omnipotence of chance and luck. If you are lucky, you see, you can escape the categories that will deter your dignity. Usually, of course, that makes you at least white. But even if you are white and also unlucky, say, for example, your mother and your father both develop Alzheimer's at a young age, and they live 20 more years, and neither you nor they have health insurance of any kind, and it costs $40,000 a year to keep them in a place equipped to take care of them, and don't even pretend that you can do this by yourself. What happens to their savings and to yours? Gone. Completely. Wiped out. You're kaput. Oh, you might eventually get so destitute that you can apply for Medicaid, but that's not going to save your retirement account or your house. And what if you yourself are dealing with a heart condition that you were born with? Bad luck, that. Wonder if you break your leg. That bad luck happens too. You just happen to be suffering a patch of bad luck and health issues. Your neighbor, however, happens to be lucky. No congenital heart problems, no broken bones by accident. And aging parents who not only don't have Alzheimer's, but are sharp as tacks and rollerblade to church on Sunday mornings and take treks to Outer Mongolia on elder hostels. Luck. No, Americans don't worship God. Sorry, I simply don't believe that anymore. The faith tradition of this country is absolute trust in luck. Las Vegas is the real capital of the nation. You can forget Washington. Sarah Colvin, all the way back in 1944, long before anti-health reform shouting matches, put it plainly, we are all gradually learning that under our economic system of free enterprise, adequate medical services, adequate health care, can never be paid for as merely a private cost. And only just adequate medical coverage, she says, genuine, excellent medical services may indeed be had, to be sure, but paid for by the rare and extremely lucky few. The people who wash cars for a living, cashier at Kroger's, make sandwiches at Subway's, manage the bookstore counter, take care of the lawns, or stock the counter at Walgreens are not likely to get that excellent health care. And folks like them can be wiped out not by double parent Alzheimer whammies, but by just the costs of the monthly diabetes supplies they need to stay healthy. Luck, attached to a predetermined and undemocratic system of haves and have-nots, determines the categories that we all live in. That is true in other nations, of course, as well as throughout human history. Even so, in America, what this means is that any proposed social program that tries to even out the playing field scares people and makes them angry. After all, good luck implies the existence of bad luck. So if you do have health care, you might be afraid you'll lose it if someone else rises to the same level as you are. There's probably not enough to go around, people reason. So better to take care of ourselves first. Better not to equal the playing field and let the have-nots in. Better to shout, better to spit, better to demonize. Life's just unfair. Get used to it. But one of our taproot traditions clearly invites us not to get used to it. In the story from the Gospel of Mark this morning, Jesus gets angry that people have substituted a comfortable belief in the omnipotence of luck and chance for faith in the possibility of inclusion, welcome, and love, what he called in his time faith in the commonwealth of God. He is angry that categories have been established which keep some people at the edge and outside of town. He's angry that people who have bad luck are actually trained to collude with that bad luck and cry out, "Keep away, keep away, I'm a leper, I'm a leper." And that's what they did, you know. The Greek word that I translated as dreaded skin disease is in fact lepra in Greek, which gives us our modern word leprosy. The problem is, and the reason I didn't use it, is that the disease leprosy, which is technically Hansen's disease, didn't exist back in Palestine in the first century. But severe eczema and psoriasis did, and quite a bit of both, and that's what they were talking about when they said lepra. Hansen's disease was not curable in those days, but those other conditions are indeed curable and can fade at time, and sometimes they fade very quickly. So the story does make sense. I also translated the word, usually translated as priest, as the official in charge of such matters, because the temple in those days was not just a religious place, but the social, political, and medical center of the whole nation. There was no separation of temple and state in those days. They were one and the same. It was also the official medical establishment. If you did have a contagious skin disease, only they in the temple, the officials, could pronounce you officially clean. What's interesting in the story is that Jesus is not against the medical establishment of his day. Go back, he says, and present yourself to the official in charge. He says, he's not a knee-jerk, I hate all authority type person. He respects the medical concerns of the Torah, the need to keep contagion from hurting the community. As in our children's story this morning, there are many kinds of effective healing approaches in the world, and they can learn from each other. But the real point of that particular story is not particular medical techniques that ancient people use that are different from our own, but that human beings actually sit down and listen to each other and respect each other and don't automatically dismiss each other. In this New Testament story, the man in question had already been to the official, and the official had said to him, "I do not declare you clean," which means in plain English, "I don't see you, I don't hear you, I don't want you, I don't love you. Get out of my sight." The story suggests that Jesus, however, could see the humanity of this long-suffering man and thus could see that he actually was indeed getting better. The official was more concerned with categories than with real human beings, and so Jesus, the Greek text implies, takes upon himself the role of a medical priest and declares, well, fuming, the text says, fuming about this systemic stigmatization, "I declare you clean. I declare you clean." Some manuscripts of the gospel were uncomfortable with Jesus' anger and changed the Greek word to one that meant compassion instead of fuming. But since another word for anger is used later in the story, the original word makes sense to me. And then Jesus sends the man back to the official as a witness against the establishment. He warns him not to get distracted to anyone by talking to anyone along the way, but to actually do something to help the healing, not just of himself, but of society, so this kind of stigmatization doesn't happen. He asks him to join him in a plan of action, in other words. In the story, Jesus really is a man of his word, too. He's being serious. He touches the man. He touches someone with a contagious skin disease that immediately made him unclean himself, unclean by contagion. And it would make him have to cry out, "Leper, leper," whenever he approached. So it says he left the cities and wandered in the countryside. And the text confirms that later. But the man who was healed was much more interested in his personal health than in healing society. Sort of like the folks today battling any form of health care that would level the playing field. So he goes out and tells everyone, "Oh, look, I'm healed, I'm healed, I'm healed. Sorry about you." A setback, to be sure. But there are setbacks all the time. The thing is, with both Gandhi and with Jesus, the setback never destroyed their faith. They had faith not in luck, not in chance, but in something greater than luck and greater than chance, transforming love, planned and organized action, hope, and a clear vision of everyone able to get access to their personal healing, which in itself would be a clear sign that society itself was on its way to being healed. So, if you're angry about something that goes on in this world, get angry, fine. But get angry about things which affect folks, push to the edge. Such anger can move you forward. But remember to transform that anger into organized action and link that action to both your vision of equality for all and your very real faith, your very real trust, your very real confidence that it's actually a possibility for visions to become reality. Without that faith, why get angry at all?